This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Charlie Sheen is demanding a raise. Really? This despite the fact that he's already the highest paid actor on television. And he's melted down multiple times in the last several weeks on the way to rehab, on the internet, and in rants on the radio. He's been so erratic that CBS stopped production on his show Two and a Half Men, the most popular sitcom on television. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Today, on ABC's Good Morning America, Charlie Sheen looked a little twitchy and overly intense, as he said.
I am on a drug. It's called Charlie Sheen.
The actor also graced NBC's Today Show with anecdotes of how badly CBS underappreciated him.
I'm tired of pretending like I'm not special. I'm tired of pretending like I'm not bitching a total frickin' rock star from Mars. And people can't figure me out. They can't process me. I don't expect them to. You can't process me with a normal brain.
On Two and a Half Men, Sheen's character mirrors his actual public persona, a debauched playboy named Charlie with a taste for booze and sex workers.
What about you, Charlie? Is there anyone special in your life?
No, not really. I mean, there's gals with special skills, but I gotta pay extra.
Sheen's feud with CBS is personal, and it's worth noting his appearances today were on ABC and NBC, says Time Magazine television writer James Poniewozik.
One would imagine there was a certain satisfaction in going to not just one, but both of CBS's major network competitors. You may not have noticed, but Charlie Sheen is a person who is occasionally motivated by vengeance.
Some people estimate Two and a Half Men to be worth as much as $250 million. Stopping production last week was a decision that cost tens of millions.
I'm not hiding from anybody.
Earlier today, Sheen was on TMZ, along with both of his girlfriends he calls his goddesses. Last week, his unhinged radio interviews included one with a description of his boss, Chuck Lorre, that reeked of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, that's Chuck's real name, mistook this rock star for his own selfish exit strategy, bro.
Lorre's first name is actually Charles. Sheen's also taken to ranting about AA. On the Today Show this morning, he described his technique for beating addiction without it.
You don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. How have you done that?
I closed my eyes and made it so with the power of my mind.
It's hardly unheard of, says Time Magazine's James Poniewozik, for networks such as ABC or NBC to put train wrecks like Sheen on news shows for ratings. But, he says, it feels unseemly to see him being given a platform.
It is weird and kind of disturbing to hear somebody treat Charlie Sheen as though his notions about curing addiction with his mind and being a warlock with Adonis DNA and tiger blood is really a serious, legitimate way of looking at the world.
And it doesn't make Poniewozik feel great about the world either, he says, that Sheen was suspended for insulting his boss, not for multiple allegations of violence against women. Today, Sheen's longtime publicist made news of his own. He announced his resignation. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
The census data also shows that Americans are in racially mixed marriages, more of them than ever before. One in seven new marriages now takes place between people of different races or ethnicities. There are more interracial couples on network television as well. They are on shows such as NBC's Parenthood, Fox's Traffic Light, and ABC's Mr. Sunshine. Still, TV critic Eric Deggans finds those shows rarely reflect the real drama of mixed marriage.
On Parenthood, Crosby Braverman and his fiancée Jasmine are so mismatched, they can't even load a dishwasher without getting in a fight.
I can't marry someone who will not let me make any decisions, okay? I'm starting to realize that you are very controlling. I mean, how we load the dishwasher?
He's flighty, she's focused. He's noncommittal, she makes long-range plans. Oh, and she's African-American, while he's a white guy. But like so many interracial couples on network TV these days, their racial and cultural differences almost never come up. Even in this awkward moment, which came during a pre-marriage counseling session in Jasmine's mom's church.
Who takes the lead when it comes to decisions about your child's education?
I do.
Have you both considered what religious instruction you'll give your child?
Well, I think we're going to probably encourage him to decide.
Yeah, but he's a child, so in the meantime, he'll go to church here, go to Sunday school, and yeah.
We never learn if the church is a black church or if Crosby feels uncomfortable there. He's more focused on their communications issues. And on its face, this seems like tremendous progress. It's a world where interracial couples face no disappointed parents, no odd questions from neighbors, and no total strangers asking why their kids are different colors. But as a black man who's been married to a white woman for nearly 20 years, I have to say, a world where interracial couples almost never discuss race doesn't feel real. What it feels like is avoidance. That's why I love this scene from an episode of Mr. Sunshine, the new sitcom featuring Friends star Matthew Perry. Here, Allison Janney from The West Wing plays a clueless boss.
There you two are!
And she's got an odd proposition for an interracial couple working in her office. A double date.
That's my fella's name, Darius Washington. Ring a bell, Alonzo?
No. Should it?
Well, I just assumed all you brothers knew each other.
But what really sold this scene for me was what the couple said after the boss walked away.
Did you just pick up on what was going on there?
Yeah, as subtle as it was, I got it.
She obviously just asked us out because she's dating a black man and then assumed that you would know him because he's a brother.
Look, it's no surprise Crystal is insensitive. This is the woman who handed Yo-Yo Ma her dry cleaning. But the point is, she wants to have dinner with us. She's trying. I think we should have said yes.
Really?
Yeah. And who knows, she spends time with us, and the next time she won't ask the guys from Los Lobos to park her car.
I've had that talk too many times. The can you believe it debriefing that happens after someone has said something either clueless or condescending. And that's what I see too many of these couples lacking on television. Race difference is an elephant in the room instead of a window into a new experience. It's time for network TV to fully tap the potential of these couples. Let them talk about the issues we're already tackling in the real world.
Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. The last night of any production at London's Royal Opera House in Covent Garden is a big, big deal. Tomorrow's performance, though, is rather different from most. A packed house will hear the final notes of the opera, Anna Nicole. And American opera houses are following its fortunes with interest to see if it will work on this side of the pond. NPR's Philip Reeves has this story.
Anna Nicole Smith had a life full of surprises. Now, in her death, there's another one. She has an opera. Not a soap opera, a real opera, at one of the world's most prestigious opera houses.
Covent Garden is seen to be this sort of bastion of the elite doing a very sort of circumscribed canon of work.
Matt Wolff's a theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune.
Obviously, the great Puccini, Verdi, Mozart, Handel operas with international superstars and prices out of reach to all but a select few. Here's an opera that has a fine cast, but it doesn't have superstars. And more importantly, it's on a topic that I don't think anyone ever thought they would see staged at the Royal Opera.
The opera tells the life story of Anna Nicole Smith, a waitress who became a Playboy centrefold, a pole dancer, an actress, and a wife. She famously married the billionaire oil tycoon J. Howard Marshall. He was 89 at the time. She was 26. He died. She fought a long, draining legal battle over his money.
Larry King lies tonight. Tonight, I guess Sir Anna Nicole Smith, the model, the actress, and former playmate of the year.
The tabloid media lapped it all up. They went on lapping it up as she became the star of her own reality TV show, went off the rails, and died of an accidental drug overdose at just 39.
I think it's like every rags-to-riches success story and every cautionary tale shoved into a blender with two bottles of tequila and three bags of sugar and whooshed up and served over 2 hours.
Richard Thomas wrote the words for Anna Nicole. He's ventured into waters like this before with Jerry Springer, the opera. Some have portrayed Anna Nicole Smith as a gold digger destroyed by her own greed. Mark Anthony Turnage, who composed the music, sees her as far more complex than that.
hopefully you fall in love with her and you're very sad when all the events turn wrong for her. So I hope people are sympathetic. I mean, we've failed in a way. If you're not, if you come out of there thinking, oh, she's just a cartoon character, she's a bit of an idiot, then we've totally failed.
But let's get serious. This has taken its toll.
This production looks like an attempt to attract a new, younger audience to opera. The 6 performances in London of Anna Nicole have sold out, so it seems to have worked. Thomas again.
I think that this has definitely attracted a new crowd. With this, I would imagine 30 to 40% would never have been to the Royal Opera.
Thomas says his priority was just to tell an unusual human story.
I love subjects which are easily dismissed. Most people would dismiss the whole story of Anna Nicole as, you know, oh, this is fodder. But I quite like those because along the way you find these lovely comedic gems and hopefully you stumble across some fantastic sort of universal themes and truths.
Hey!
Some of the language is certainly true to life. To get into this show, you must be 16 or over. Thomas and Turnage concede there are words in their opera you don't usually hear at the Royal Opera House.
20 F words, yeah. 1 C word, 3 bastardizations of the C word, which I've invented.
As they filed out from a recent performance of Anna Nicole, audience members had mixed feelings.
Excellent. And really beautiful combination of comedy turning to tragedy, you know, and that wonderful theatrical mix.
It's more of a bad musical, not even an opera. There was no music to start with, it was just cacophony, just sounds.
That's Steve Taylor and Rafai Manoukian. Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune says there are some stunning moments.
The single best visual moment in it was this huge mattress, which seems to take over the entire stage. The implication being that Anna Nicole's entire life now is defined by two things. One, a bed, and secondly, things that are big. Her breasts, the financial assets of her octogenarian husband, who quickly dies. Everything about her is big, 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 bed, bed, bed. And that, I thought, worked very well.
But did Wolfe end up feeling sympathy for Anna Nicole?
I think you go away thinking, God, she's pathetic, and it's all very sad. And it is very sad, and she was pathetic, but was she tragic? I'm not sure. I think the jury is out on that.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
And that piece on the opera, Anna Nicole, was compiled with reporting by NPR's London producer, Katie Bilboa.
Oh, it's so much more classy to hear Anna Nicole discussed in an English accent, don't you think?
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. On broadcast television, the February rating sweeps ended Wednesday. Sweeps periods are when the networks compete aggressively to attract the largest audiences, because those are the numbers used to set advertising rates for the next 3 months. That's why, now that the February sweeps are over, almost all network shows are reruns. And it's also why we're about to face a new onslaught of reality TV shows. Reality shows are a low-cost, low-risk way of rolling the dice and hoping for a sudden hit. If it doesn't catch on, no big deal. You finish out the cycle and replace it with something else, or scrap it immediately if the ratings are that low. But if it hits big, it's a major moneymaker. Yet a decade into the current cycle of broadcast TV reality shows, much of the novelty has worn off. Even the durable programs have to rely on tricks to keep audiences coming back. Donald Trump's The Apprentice series on NBC has upped the ante with celebrity editions for a while now, even though its definition of celebrity is way too generous. This Sunday, the newest cycle of Celebrity Apprentice premieres, and the loosest cannon in its arsenal is Gary Busey, whose level of quirkiness has fueled other reality shows in the past. So here he is, misbehaving again, with predictable unpredictability. And that's the problem with reality TV this year. Even when the programs aren't familiar reruns, the contestants are. On CBS, we have former Survivor contestants Russell and Boston Rob fighting it out on new teams. On the same network's The Amazing Race, we have 16 losing teams from former editions lining up to try again. Another problem is that even a new show can seem old because its parts are so familiar. ABC this weekend launches Secret Millionaire, which is an unwatchable ripoff of the nearly as manipulative undercover boss on CBS. Is there any broadcast TV reality show with a spark of originality these days? Yes, there is. And, like Secret Millionaire and Celebrity Apprentice and The Amazing Race, it shows up this Sunday. It's NBC's America's Next Great Restaurant, and it comes from the producers of Bravo's Top Chef. There are two variations that make this new show stand out. One is that instead of having cooks compete for prizes or a dream job in a top restaurant, as they do on Top Chef and Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen, this time they compete for investors and the chance to launch a dream business. That's a familiar idea, too, from such shows as ABC's Shark Tank. But in America's Next Great Restaurant, all the contestants are competing in the same category for the backing to open a chain of three restaurants. They're trying to impress the likes of chefs Bobby Flay and Curtis Stone, and this time the panel isn't just judging, it's mentoring. Here's the way the narrator describes it in Sunday's premiere.
Each week, the contestants will work side by side with the investors to further develop their concepts. They'll hire chefs, design a uniform, operate their own food trucks, and build their restaurants. And each week, someone will go home.
I'm sorry, we will not be investing in your restaurant.
I know that I'm a good chef.
I'm gonna miss her so much.
The stakes couldn't be any higher.
The stakes, in that context, don't refer to juicy grilled pieces of meat. But those come later, along with casual restaurants built around grilled cheese sandwiches, Indian fusion, and meatballs. In episode one, the judges hear the pitches, taste the food, and select the finalists. In week two, the contestants are taken to an open-air mall to set up booths and serve one sample item to a crowd of 1,000 people, each of whom has a vote. And the judges are checking them out, too, passing judgment on everything from the food to the logo and even the name. Here are Bobby Flay and Curtis Stone sampling the wares of one contestant who's serving up small bowls of meatballs. He's nervous as the judges taste a sample, happy as they ask for more, then nervous again as they turn around and start questioning some of the customers, asking them specifically about the name he's chosen for his would-be restaurant.
What have we got here?
Hey, what's happening?
We got saucy balls, sir. How are you?
The amount of sauce compared with a meatball, they really are saucy balls. It's good, sir.
Thank you, thank you.
Talk to us about the name and the logo.
Putting grandma up there, to me it shows that you're going to have a nice home-cooked meal here.
Do you think that the name Saucy Balls, do you think there's anyone that might find it a little bit bad taste?
I think we'll attract a lot more people than we'll offend with that name.
You want another one? You all right? Yeah.
Woo! Yeah!
The food is delicious. Doesn't offend anybody?
Nobody's offended by it?
No, it's not offensive. It's like, if you're with your friend, but you wouldn't be like, hey, grandma, let's go eat at Saucy Balls, you know?
I suspect that with this show, as with American Idol, a finalist need not win to succeed. After a few weeks of exposure on a show like this, they might find other investors eager to help them make their dreams come true. But for that to happen, America's Next Great Restaurant has to last a few weeks. And most new TV shows, like most new restaurants, fail quickly. But America's Next Great Restaurant, with a tone that is more positive than negative, is one show I expect will beat the odds. The judges are sincere and likable. The show taps into a common dream. It makes me smile, and at times, it even makes me hungry.